Coming up on Philosophy Talk...
You can't dispute whether or not rationality and progress in knowledge is possible. Of course it's possible.
Can reason save us?
Save us from what?
Demagogues, climate deniers, religious zealots, the forces of unreason are everywhere.
But disease and extreme poverty are down, while life expectancy, literacy, and equality are up. All triumphs of human reason.
There are systematic discrepancies between reasoning, that is, how the human mind proceeds left to its own devices, and reason in the sense of our best understanding of what follows from what.
Are we really living in an age of progress?
I'm not making a prognostication that will succeed. I'm challenging the idea that there's some inherent reason that we can't.
We ask renowned cognitive scientist Steven Pinker.
Author of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress.
Can reason save us?
Thinking about anything is reason.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Holding hands at midnight, neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Is reason our only guide to the true and the good?
Or can reasonable people disagree on what is true and good?
Is it a mistake to fetishize reason?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Kepler's Books in Menlo Park, California.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Literature and Philosophy Initiative.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're asking, can reason save us?
Save us from what?
Well, demagogues busy trying to undermine democracy. Climate deniers, you know, addicted to fossil fuels. Religious fanatics who see unspeakably evil acts as like their ticket to paradise, Josh. You know, the forces of unreason, they're everywhere.
Forces of unreason, you sound like some kind of mannequin, like you think there's this cosmic battle of the forces of darkness and the forces of light.
Well, yeah, of course there is.
Well, okay, so if you see it that way, at least it might come as some comfort to know that those forces of darkness have been losing ever since the Enlightenment.
Come on, how do you explain the current political situation in the United States, or Brexit in your own homeland, or the mess in the Middle East? How do you explain all that then?
Yeah, okay, but take a longer view. I mean, think about the abolition of slavery, the rise of democracy, the defeat of fascism, colonialism, Stalinism, or not to mention progress in science, technology, medicine. I mean, all these things are triumphs of reason, Ken.
Yeah, Josh. But, like, take the Nazis, for example. They weren't argued out of existence. They were bludgeoned to death, dude.
All right. Look, the forces of reason sometimes need help from other kinds of force. I grant you that.
Yeah, like the force of arms. By the way, without the Red Army, Stalin's Red Army, Hitler would have never been stopped. So I want to ask you, why did you put communism on your list of defeated horribles?
Well, Stalinism, I mean, Stalin was a monster.
Oh, yeah, but Marx, he was as much a man of the Enlightenment as that you so admire, I know, as Adam Smith or Immanuel Kant. I mean, look, he believed in scientific rationality. He was opposed to religious dogma. He was a huge advocate for human dignity, so...
Yeah, well, you know, Marxism is wonderful in theory. It's a great theory. But in practice, unfortunately, it also gave us the gulag and, you know, Mao's Cultural Revolution.
Which just goes to show you, Josh, you should not fetishize reason the way you do.
Wait, you're blaming the gulag on reason?
Well, Stalin had his scientists and engineers, right? I mean, they adhered to the canons of scientific rationality, otherwise they could have done their thing. I mean, he had this huge collection of party apparatchiks. They managed a sprawling state. How do you think they did that? by standard bureaucratic rationality.
How exactly do you think the great leader controlled this group of oh-so-rational henchmen exactly?
Well, he, like in any large organization, various rational incentives.
Rational incentives like fear, intimidation? I mean, these aren't your everyday tools of rational management.
Well, yeah, they were from Stalin's point of view.
Okay, so let me see if I understand you correctly. You're saying the gulag is just like one more manifestation of bureaucratic rationality?
Well, yeah. I mean, not okay. It's not one that you or I would use. I think you wouldn't use it.
Not currently.
But it worked pretty well for Stalin for a long time. You got to admit that.
It worked. So it's all about whether it works. I mean, you sound like some kind of relativist, Ken. I mean, next thing you're going to be telling me the reason was responsible for the Holocaust.
Well, not all by itself. But surely, who could possibly deny that reason played a major role in the Holocaust? Who could deny that?
Me. Reason didn't give us the Holocaust. Virulent anti-Semitism did, Ken. I mean, look, if you're the kind of person who sees Jews as cockroaches fit only for extermination, there's something wrong with you. You're not using your reason correctly.
I see your problem. Here's the thing. You're not aware that unfortunately, I mean, and it really is unfortunate, reason doesn't and it can't tell us what to value. It just takes whatever we value, you know, wherever they come from, it takes them as given, and then it tells us how to build a world in accordance with those values. So yeah, here's the very sad fact. If you start out with like anti-Semitic values as input, then yeah, and you let reason run, it's going to give you the Nazi state as its output. Reason, this wonderful thing that you so love.
I can't agree with you, Ken. Look, I'm with Kant on this. I think reason can and should determine our values.
You so over-romanticize reason. I mean, come on. You're a literary guy. Haven't you read your Nietzsche?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, but all I'm going to say to that is, look, if Nietzsche's view implies that the Nazis were rational, then he's just wrong on this. He can't be right. Reason went dark in the Nazis.
Look, I abhor the Nazis as much as you do, but that, I'm afraid that doesn't make them irrational, Josh. It just makes them different.
Different as in evil.
Well, yeah, okay, evil. Yeah, different as in evil. I agree with you.
Well, thank goodness for that. Okay, but look, I think you're still vastly underestimating reason. I think that's the mistake you're making. And I think, look, if we're going to be saved from those things you were mentioning a moment ago, reason's our only hope.
Here's what I will concede. Before we get to decide who gets to keep these lovely words, reason, rationable, reasonableness, all that stuff. But you know what? These words have always been contested. They were even contested during the Enlightenment, Hume on one side, Kant on the other. So,
and that's why we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to give us a sense of how contested they are even today. She files this report.
Reason has made some powerful headway over time. We don't burn witches at the stake for sport so much anymore. But are we becoming more reasonable, or is our unreasonableness just evolving with the times, taking new forms?
Go down the rabbit hole and I'll show you how far it goes.
This is Alex Jones. His alternative news website, InfoWars, gets 10 million monthly visits, making it more popular than The Economist and Newsweek.
Everyone's having their water poisoned. Everyone's having deadly vaccines pushed on them. Everyone is having weaponized television aimed at them. Pizzagate is real. Sandy Hook is a synthetic, completely fake. Vegas is as phony as a $3 bill or as Obama's birth certificate.
The attacks in Orlando were a false flag terror attack.
That's what a false flag is, and we've never had one so open to shut as Oklahoma City. I am the person that popularized the term false flag.
Or for a different flavor of the modern day person's imperviousness to reason, there's Gwyneth Paltrow's wellness company, Goop.
Today on the Buzz List, interesting items from Gwyneth Paltrow's website, Goop. Coming in at number 3, psychic vampire repellent. This sprayable elixir combines gem healing and aromatic therapeutic oils to banish bad vibes and bloodsuckers. Coming in at number 2, the Darwin jellyfish tank for $1,600. You can house your own jellyfish, but again, it is sold out. However, you can rent one for $352 per day.
Despite being called dangerous by Truth in Advertising and paying out to consumer protection lawsuits, Goop has an estimated annual revenue of $20 million. We want to believe. It's a lever that easily overpowers cognition. And political pundits know this. We've all learned by now. Appealing to an audience's favorite beliefs is essential. But reasonable discourse is expendable. So let's just take a second to listen to how the discourse is sounding.
You're not answering the question.
The law lied about it. I am answering it.
Kellyanne, that's not what I asked. No one's questioning.
All right, Kellyanne, can I just keep us on the rails here for just a second?
Because you did not answer the question.
He thought,
what
no, no,
did
no,
he
that's
say? What, that's the
he
question. What's
Vladimir
the answer?
Putin.
You did not answer the question. I know you like
about.
To pivot. I get it.
Are you interested in having Sharia law in America as law?
Who is?
Yeah.
Islam.
What about you?
Islam.
No, are you?
No.
Okay, are you? Show me where
this
they're making
national
anywhere.
Movement.
If we, this is a national movement?
Yes.
This looks like a band of freaking idiots over here.
You just call me a bunch of stupid hillbillies.
Why is it stupid to be afraid of
here?
Sharia?
Why
is it bad to be afraid of Sharia? Why is it stupid?
That's what you
horrible.
Said. You said,
well, you know
you said that
when
it was
people
it's okay.
Be here end it's, up murdering the children of American citizens.
You know what's horrible?
What's
when,
horrible?
When the president of the United States whips up people to beat the hell out of people.
Neo-fascist Becky right here. Becky the neo-fascist right here.
Punch a Nazi, stop being performative. Punch a Nazi, stop yelling about it, be about the shit.
I've been fighting for like 3 months. I've put myself at risk
of
arrest all the time.
You're still white. You're still responsible. This is your fault. You're inherently racist.
This is not effective. You don't answer one charge by pointing to the other administration.
I did answer.
We'll get to that in a minute. We will get
I'm
to
not
that.
Answering
no,
the charge
over
with
me.
It, Megan.
I'll give you the chance and then
you're
give me the chance.
You're talking over me. The minute I challenge you, you tell me I don't know what I'm talking about?
Because you don't.
I understand the intensity. The stakes are high when it feels like your team is fighting for a little control over the world before the others ruin its chances. So we retreat into our atomized information economies and sling mud when we can. The chaos and mistrust wouldn't be so tragic if the people who control the economy didn't find it all so perfectly useful. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that uplifting tour of the rational landscape, Liza. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my Stanford colleague, Joshua Landy, and we're coming to you from Kepler's Books and Menlo Park.
Our guest today is a professor of psychology at Harvard University and a world-renowned cognitive scientist. He's the author of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Steven Pinker. So, Steve, I have to say I love this book, and one of the things I love about it is that it makes a really strong case for the value of reason. But, you know, some people might say, why do you need to do that? I mean, you know, reason, it's obvious that reason is a great thing. So what was it that made you, you know, wake up one morning and think, that's what the world needs, a book making the case for reason?
The main inspiration was coming across data sets showing that, contrary to popular impressions, there has been an enormous amount of progress in the human condition. People are living longer, they are living safer lives, they are less likely to be poor, less likely to be illiterate, less likely to die of disease and hunger. And that these developments did not happen by accident. The universe doesn't lift us upward on an escalator. They are the result of people applying reason and science to make humanity better off. And it's underappreciated. People don't know that there's been improvement, therefore they're not curious as to what led to the improvement.
So you think it's not obvious that reason led to the, I mean, are there people who deny that reason led to the improvement?
There are people who are unaware that there's been improvement. And there is a strange movement coming from my own professional tribe, cognitive scientists, who have shown how the many ways in which human beings are not so rational, there's a long list of biases and fallacies and errors that the human mind is vulnerable to. But this has led to, I think, the false implication that we shouldn't even bother to make discourse more rational because people are inherently irrational. They're never convinced by facts and logic, so let's just lie back and enjoy it.
I often hear people saying, memory, how can you possibly rely on all memory is fabrication? And I ask them, well, do you remember where your car is? if it was all fabrication, we wouldn't be able to.
So I want to ask another question, though. So look, there are people, philosophers, who think that, you know, reason is just an instrumental thing. It can calculate means to end, but it can help you set your ultimate ends. And that was kind of the debate between me and Josh. So I just wondered, do you have a view about that? Can reason set ultimate ends, or is it just an instrumental?
Yeah. Well, I think that's literally true in the sense that, to take an example, if you had a child who was dying of a disease and you had a drug that you knew could cure the disease, it is not a logical error to withhold the drug from the child. That is true. On the other hand, it does somehow seem perverse to do it. Why does it? It's because each one of us values our own lives, and there is no logical basis for me valuing my life over anyone else's, in which case I have to grant equal recognition to your interest. Now, again, this is not a logical deduction, but it seems pretty reasonable.
Wait a minute, but that suggests that you think that Josh... So I said, well, look, if you start out with Nazi values, anti-Semitic values, and you apply just instrumental reason, it's going to produce reason. Is going to produce this Nazi state. It's going to be managed by instrumental reason and all that sort of stuff. He says, no, that can't happen because reason won't let you have those Nazi values. I mean...
Well, for one thing, the Nazis actually did believe in a large number of unreasonable things together with their repugnant value of not valuing Jewish lives. They believed that Jews stabbed Germany in the back what ended World War I. They believed that the Jews were a biologically different species whose blood would contaminate Gentiles. A number of beliefs that are factually incorrect. In addition, the fact that they would jail or shoot people who disagreed with them is ipso facto evidence that their belief system was not based on reason, because if it was, they'd be happy to let the argument proceed because they'd win the argument.
And they're clearly using the tools of irrationality. I mean, you look at footage of Hitler giving those speeches, you don't think, well, that's a rational guy. Like clearly his problem is being reading too much analytic philosophy.
Well, he's crazy. No, Hitler's crazy.
But he's not just crazy. He's also exploiting irrational tendencies on the part of the
irrational
people.
Tendencies.
Yes, irrational tendencies on the part of the people.
He was pretty good at adjusting his. I mean, again, I don't share his values, but he was pretty good at adjusting means to ends. Right. So there's a lot to dig in here. I'll remind you, this is Philosophy Talk. And we're coming to you from Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. Our guest is the renowned cognitive scientist Steven Pinker.
In our next segment, we're going to take a deeper look at the nature of reason. Is it the only guide to the true and the good? Is there even always one thing that's reasonable to do or believe in the first place? Or does it depend on where we stand?
Probing the nature of reason, along with questions from our live and reasonable audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
So bright. Well, I got to wear shades.
Thanks to our musical guests, Tiffany Austin and Adam Shulman. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Steven Pinker. And we're asking whether reason can save us.
Can reason only tell us how to achieve our ultimate aims, or can it also tell us what ultimate aims are worth adopting? Join the conversation by raising your hand, and the microphone will come around to you.
Steve, so look, philosophers have talked about the nature of reason for a long, long time, way Aristotle, Plato, none of that's was scientific. It was like a priori and intuitive. I want you to put your cognitive scientist hat on. And from the perspective of cognitive science, how should we think of reason in this 21st century? Is it like a single capacity? Was Descartes right? Was Plato right? Is it a bundle of distinct capacities? Tell us the most astounding thing that's cognitive science has discovered about reason.
There are systematic discrepancies between reasoning, that is, how the human mind proceeds left to its own devices, and reason in the sense of our best understanding of what follows from what. So a long list of discrepancies between how we think and how we ought to think.
So there's like this normative, how we ought to think, what counts as a good inference. Philosophers revel in that stuff. The norms of rationality, right? And you're saying the striking thing that cognitive science has discovered is that we don't live up to those norms? Our brain is not designed to live up to those norms?
Unassisted. Now, of course, it can't be the case that we're incapable of rationality. Otherwise, we'd never be able to make the argument that people are systematically irrational,
right,
because we wouldn't have a benchmark of rationality against which to compare the human mind.
Who makes that argument? So, people like you.
No,
what about people like that? I mean, you're the world-renowned cognitive scientist. You make that argument. What about the ordinary folk?
Well, you the argument would be incoherent unless we had a standard of what rationality was. You couldn't say people are irrational because there'd be no such thing as rationality. And we wouldn't be able to have the conversation in the first place, or a conversation about anything else for that matter. You wouldn't be able to have this program if there wasn't a standard of rationality that you were exercising.
So it seems like, right, I mean, I agree, and it seems like the question then is, okay, how do we get from one to the other? How do we get from our flawed everyday reasoning processes to this more normative standard of reason?
Yeah, and that's where the norms and institutions of reason come in. Principles like free speech, like open debate, like the avoidance of fallacies, like arguing ad hominem or arguing from the historical origin of an argument, the demand that if a claim is empirical, it be confronted against evidence from the world. All of these things that aren't terribly natural to us, but once we've implemented them, we've seen that collectively they make us smarter than any one of us is individually.
That's what I was going to say, collectively, because all the stuff you were talking about requires kind of collective structures. But my vision, right, is a capacity in me, in my brain. I open my eyes, I focus, I see the clock. I don't need your help to see the clock, right? I may need your help to see that it's a clock because I need the concept that I get that. But my hearing doesn't require your aid. I mean, so if reason is some like capacity in my brain, why do I need the help of all you guys to stay on track?
Well, in fact, one of the fundamental discoveries of philosophy is that that naive realism, just opening your eyes and seeing the world as it is false. That there
are about that.
Perceptual illusions, and just as there are cases where our eyes deceive us, there are cases where our minds deceive us. To show where your eyes deceive you, you pull out a yardstick, you use better methods of assessing loudness, and the same thing for logical coherence.
Well, but there's something, there's a capacity in my brain for vision. There's a capacity in my brain for audition, for sensing things, right? For sensory motor coordination. That's in my brain, right? And it just kind of runs. There are illusions and like that. But is there a capacity in my brain? Because all that stuff you talk about correction and the norms, that doesn't seem like it's just in my brain. It's somehow in us.
But surely it's a bit of both, right, Ken? I mean, I think the norms and institutions point is a really important and deep one, right, that collectively we can achieve much more in the domain of reason than we can individually. But, you know, you read Kahneman, and one way to read Kahneman is to say, oh, my God, we're all system one. We're all just blindly
distinguished, but you make system one versus system two in Kahneman.
So Daniel Kahneman has a distinction between system one, which is sort of our automatic, kind of heuristic, very flawed way of processing the data from the world. But we also have system two, which is our reasoning capacity, where we can actually reflect on that and say, oh, well, boy, this straw in my drink looks bent, but I guess maybe it isn't actually bent.
Yeah.
So I can apply a reason. So, you know, I tend to agree with Steve that even at an individual level, we're not doomed because we've got our system two.
So
even
do you like that? I mean, do you like this distinction? Because there are people who don't like the system one, system two distinction, but are you one who likes it or dislikes it?
Yeah, I think it captures something about cognition, and I would just add that the system two works not just because we can put on our thinking caps and sit back and reflect and ponder slowly, but also we have social institutions, such as the fact that if we make a claim, someone else can disagree with us and we have to defend it.
Right.
Or if it's an empirical claim, we're called on to give evidence, to do experiments, to consult data. So it's the social institutions that our system two recruits in the first place and insists on applying that makes system two effective.
So if I were trying to ask, well, what actually is this capacity for reason? It's partly in our psychology, but it's partly somehow distributed in our collective lives together, because you are like an instrument for me. You're like part of my cognitive system. Because I could, it's like Mill says, you know, anybody who just knows his own side of the issue doesn't know the issue, or I can't remember the exact
word. You don't even know that.
It's a, right. Yeah, it's a beautiful quote. So I need the other person, right? And somehow it's something about my mind that's made for this kind of collective cognitive activity.
That's right, but it also crucially depends on the rules of the game. It isn't enough just to immerse a person in a community, because we know there can be collective delusions, there can be...
Well, like the Nazis.
Yes, like the Nazis, like the madness of crowds, like witch hunts, that the groupthink, there have to be norms that allow new ideas to come in and challenge consensus of an in-group, and the demand to challenge ideas against empirical reality whenever they bear on the state of the world.
So I want to open this up to the audience for questions. I remind you, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking whether reason can save us with Steven Pinker. And we'll get to your questions in a second, but I want to put another issue to you. Because I wonder something. Do you think the Enlightenment was like a contingent, historically specific, culturally specific achievement? Or was it just the outgrowth somehow, like in a Hegelian way, of the natural endowment of the human mind? Maybe you don't have grand theories. I mean, yeah. Hegel has grand theories. I think you tend to...
I don't think it was inevitable, but I think that it was more than just a historically contingent cultural development. It wasn't just a fad. It wasn't just a set of memes. Reason is reason. It's what we are using now, and it is available to anyone who thinks about anything at any time, which is why Enlightenment themes were not uniquely Western, but have popped up in other historical periods, in classic Arab civilization, in Mughal India, simply because you can't avoid reason once you start thinking about anything, because thinking about anything is reason.
Well, wait a minute. Why does anybody resist the Enlightenment values then? I mean, if they're kind of, I don't know if you didn't quite say they were inevitable, but they were really compelling, right? But why were there the Salem witch hunts and all that stuff? Why was there Hitler? Why was there Stalin's gulag?
I think the Enlightenment is not cognitively natural, Enlightenment values. I think that we naturally fall back into tribalism, into authoritarianism, into magical thinking, and that it is actually quite a stretch to get us to realize that we have to shelve a lot of our intuitions and gut feelings and instincts in order to enjoy the fruits of reason.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park, California, in front of a live audience, a really reasonable live audience, and I think that we have questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Thank you so much. My name is Michael. I'm out of San Francisco. And up to this point of the dialectic, in the shortest possible way, how are we differentiating reason from objective moral good?
That's a really good question. Kant thinks reason gives you morality. It's just like the commandments of morality are categorically binding on all rational beings as such. Hume says, blah. Nietzsche says, Kant over-romanticizes reason. Do you think morality comes from reason alone, like Kant?
Not reason alone, but reason combined with a valuing of one's own continued existence. And it's pretty hard to see how you could have reason without that. So I don't want to say that it is a logical implication, but I would say it's a short step.
But that's all you need? You only need reason plus valuing of your own continued existence?
Well, and you need a community of people in discourse. Your own well-being has to hinge on the existence and behavior of other people.
Right.
That is, you have to have a motive to persuade them of something. Once you do that, it's very hard to persuade them that your interests are special because you're you and they're not. There's nothing magical about the pronoun I, as I think it was Sidgwick who said.
Yeah. Well, you know... I can imagine somebody saying, well, why should I? And when I say to people, gosh, you know, I'd rather drive this huge truck even though it's polluting the environment. And they say, well, you really shouldn't do that. I mean, you got to think of the future generations. Why should that person listen to them? Because after all, aren't there cases where we shouldn't? I mean, that's a case where we probably should listen to the community. But if I'm saying, don't burn that person because you think she's a witch.
Yeah.
And they're saying, no, we all agree. That's a case where, I mean, so why should I listen to my community?
Yeah, there are two questions there. One of them is, what will actually be effective in getting someone to stop, to trade in the SUV for the Prius or the bicycle?
Right.
And the other is, what would actually count as a good reason for them to do it, even
exactly.
if they happen to be unreasonable?
Right.
So the first is a matter of persuasion. It's a sort of a psychological question. The other is more of a normative question.
Right, and I'm more interested in the normative question. Yeah.
Well, the normative question is, well, would you agree to, if previous generations had done something that ruined the environment that prevented you from living the life that you would like to live, could you justify that? And if not, if you would object and say, hey, you living 100 years ago, what you did was wrong because of the way it affects me, then you can't turn around and say what I'm doing now is okay, even if it hurts generations subsequent to me.
We've got more questions from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk Show.
Hi, I'm Domas from Lithuania. I wonder, how do you reach the unreasonable in the modern age when they have the modern witch hunts on Twitter and other forums, and how do you make them change their minds instead of them, you know, getting rid of you?
Good question. What do you think, Steve?
You know, how will I change the world? I don't know the answer, but
one book at a time.
one book at a time. You know, I don't know how you can accomplish what we know has been accomplished, namely that in many regards, the society as a whole has gotten more reasonable. We even in the fever swamps of the right, there is no move now to reinstitute Jim Crow laws or laws against homosexuality. Most people, when their child gets sick, they don't call a witch doctor, they don't have an exorcism, they really do take them to a doctor. Most people don't believe in unicorns. So there are ways in which somehow the society has changed through the proliferation of ideas, sometimes from the top down, sometimes through social shaming, sometimes through practical effects that everyone can see.
But let me give you a view. I don't know if I believe it, but but it seems to me plausible. Okay, there are a lot of, I'm going to call them the cognitive avant-garde. The cognitive avant-garde do science and create new things, and they are the leading edge of reason's future, okay? Now, here's one thing about being a social human. A lot of us get the free ride on the cognitive avant-garde, right? I mean, I'm no Einstein, but I understand physics. So now, the social structures bring lots of people along, but they don't bring everybody along. So I don't know that reason necessarily spreads throughout the entire collectivity. I mean, yeah, there is a cognitive avant-garde committed to reason, and they talk to each other, and they cooperate, and some people get pulled along in their wake, but a lot of people get left behind. And then there are those people who want to exploit the people who are left behind and manipulate them, and they're geniuses at doing that. So it's not clear to me that unbalanced everything's going to... I mean, the cognitive avant-garde gets the benefit of it, and those get pulled in their wake, but lots of people are the prey of the sophists, as it were, right? Well, the marketers and all that stuff.
I think that's all true, and I think that we don't have the ability to predict when reason will prevail, but the fact that there are examples where it has prevailed kind of emboldens us to think that it is possible if we keep up the effort and if we understand a little bit better how so the dynamics of belief propagation work, whether it's through schools, whether it's through media. Right. But really, we don't have a debate now over whether we should have segregated drinking fountains, or whether gay people could be hired as teachers, or whether women should have the vote, or whether you should have an exorcism if your child gets sick. Somehow, despite all of our irrationality, we've managed to just put some things, not completely, but largely outside the arena of respectable discourse.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Angela from San Mateo. There is supposedly like 150 individual biases that everyone possesses. Given that, and given our tendency to look for affirmation, how do you figure that the group is not just leading you astray?
Yeah, to reiterate a point that I made earlier, first of all, we know that somehow we have succeeded because science has discovered DNA and the atom. We have eliminated smallpox. We've sent people to the moon. We've extended human lifespan. We've reduced child mortality. We've reduced famine. So something is working despite these 150 biases. And I suspect that what it is are institutions like science, like a free press, like a liberal democracy, like the rule of law, that allows us to overcome these biases collectively, even though if any of us had to rediscover human ingenuity from scratch, those biases would keep us at square one.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking whether reason can save us with Steven Pinker from Harvard University and author of Enlightenment Now.
In our final segment, we'll ask how we can give reason, truth, and goodness more sway over our lives and give less sway to nefarious passions and prejudices.
We're coming to you from Kepler's Books in Menlo Park, California. We'll take more questions from our live and lively and rational
and enlightened
audience and enlightenment too when Philosophy Talk continues.
What a wonderful world. What a wonderful world.
Thanks again to our live musical guests, Tiffany Austin and Adam Shulman. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're asking whether reason can save us with Steve Pinker from Harvard University. Steve, I want to go back to the question, how can even perfectly rational individual cognizers rationally going about it, it doesn't necessarily add up to a rational collective decision. I think this is one of the hard problems of the 21st century. So what do you think?
Yes, no, we obviously can't optimize everything. Everyone's preferences or is even any criterion by which everyone's preferences can be simultaneously optimized. On the other hand, you can't dispute whether or not rationality and progress in knowledge is possible. Of course it's possible. We've eliminated smallpox. We've sent someone to the moon. We've invented the internet and the smartphone and extended human lifespan. So something has improved things, even if it hasn't optimized
things. That's right. But still, take a problem like global warming, which is a collective action problem. Right, which I can't just come up. I suppose I could have the killer technology that sells it, but that's, you know, if the tipping point gets too long, I got to make people adopt and use that technology and all this stuff. Right, so we've got these collective action problems, and the difference between now and before is that we have impacts on a global scale, but we don't really have global institutions, or at least not adequate global institutions, that coordinate us all. So I don't know. I think we could be headed for like deep disaster, even if we're all individually perfectly rational.
If I can add to that, just to try to make it a little worse for you.
Okay.
I mean, I'm a big fan of reason, as you are, but I have a worry in this particular case. The worry would be, well, in all the other cases you're talking about, there isn't really a tension between the kind of progress that comes out of these Enlightenment values and institutions. But here, it seems as though the progress depends upon technological advancement that is causing climate change. And so here it seems like there's a real problem for the view. We can't just say, well, let's sort of sick Enlightenment values on it. Let's sick progress on it, because progress is the very thing that's been causing the problem in the first place.
Well, no, because if it's causing the potential for disaster, that's not progress. I mean, I think we would all agree.
Well,
but the thing about reason is it can always step back and assess the problems that the application of reason in the past has caused so far. And so we can indeed frame the technological question as, given that we have improved our physical standard of living so far at the cost of the environment, how do we change that trade-off so that we can enjoy the same benefit of energy capture, of moving people around, heating homes, cooling homes, making cement, without releasing massive amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere?
I think you're more optimistic about that.
That itself is a... Well, the thing is, I'm not making a prognostication that will succeed. I'm challenging the idea that there's some inherent reason that we cannot succeed.
Yeah, but I don't think you're...
And then going back to the collective active problem, once again, I'm not going to make a prediction that I know that we're going to solve it. Maybe we won't solve it. Maybe there will be a disaster. However, I don't think it's a problem that in principle we cannot solve it, because we know that collective action problems have been solved on a global scale through global institutions. Again, I'm not guaranteeing that this will happen, but there is a pathway by which everyone agrees to a sacrifice
like
the Paris Accords.
Let's get some more.
So the root is there. There's not a guarantee that we'll take it, just that there's no in principle reason that we can't.
I agree about that. Welcome to Philosophy Talks there. What's your comment, guys?
Ali, I'm from Iran. I think it's a little bit unfair to judge a reason with advances in technology. You know, technology is something that reason is kind of the foundation. But, has reason made us happier? Like sending man to the moon, is it something valuable, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's two parts of it. One of them is there can be things that make us better off that don't necessarily make us happier. But in general, the answer is we have gotten happier. On average, a majority of countries for which we have data over the decades on levels of happiness show that in a majority of those countries, happiness has increased. The United States, by the way, is not one of them. But a majority, 87% of countries for which we do have data show that they have gotten happier.
So Josh, you have a...
Yeah, so one way to think about this question is, hooray for reason, hooray for science, hooray for progress, but, you know, what about enchantment, right? So this is something I think a lot about in my work, as the reach of science expands, so the space for enchantment diminishes. And in your book, enchantment shows up as things like ogres, witches, and demons. But I think it's also like sprites and nymphs and fairy godmothers, and you know, and it's love and it's art and it's things like that. And so I want us to kind of rephrase the happiness question this way. You know, doesn't happiness also depend on enchantment? And is the space for enchantment just gonna shrink and shrink and shrink until
he's enchanted by science?
Yeah. No, I'm also I'm enchanted by love and by art. The sprites and fairies you can keep.
Okay.
So
they were metaphorical.
Yeah. This is I deal with this in Enlightenment now because I know there is the view that, well, we've eliminated famine and we've doubled human lifespans and we've reduced child mortality by a factor of 100 and we've eliminated war for most of the planet. But yeah, that's all kind
of
boring.
But wait a minute, you know about the hedonic treadmill. You know, you get more and more stuff and you say, well, is that all there is? Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. What is the point? What is the purpose? Right. What is my life for? What do I give my life over to?
Well, you know, I really don't think that eliminating disease and starvation and poverty and war is all that boring and meaningless. but even if the hedonic treadmill were true, and it turns out the hedonic treadmill is not true, that the studies that show that people are not happier after winning the lottery, that turns out to be wrong. People really are happier after winning the lottery.
Well, I know what I'm doing tonight.
even if that were true, living to the age of 80 is better than living to the age of 30.
Okay, that's true. That's true.
But I do agree that we need to have a more heroic narrative of the fact that we are eliminating child mortality and we are reducing war, and how you can restore the sense of purpose and nobility and heroism and excitement to things like world peace and, say, achieving the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Now, maybe that doesn't get the blood pumping, but it could if properly advanced and framed.
Okay, so, Steve, I want to do something that we do from time to time here on Philosophy Talk. We're going to make you czar of rationality. You have these plenary powers, and you get to change whatever institutions, whatever laws, whatever practices, educational practices, whatever you like. Nobody can resist it. So your task is to make reason govern our lives more and passion and prejudice and bias less. So what are you going to do in your day as czar?
I guess force people to defend their beliefs against people who criticize them.
You're going to play John Stuart Mill, in other words.
That would be a good start. And I would advance the norm both in education and in intellectual discourse in general, in op-eds, in political debates, that you have to justify your beliefs about the world by citing evidence and with statistical sophistication. That is, you can't allow yourself to fall prey to the biases that Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman have shown.
I like the czar a lot.
I like this, yes. Yeah, you're going to send everybody to our university.
Right, right, right. What are you going to do? But to me, I don't know if it's the same point, but I feel like there's a connection to another point that you make. I think brilliant. For me, it's actually the core point of the book, that there's too many Eeyores, you know, saying that everything's terrible and there's no progress. And you know, one of the things that I love is that you point out the great danger of that way of thinking about things, that it leads to apathy or even to, you know, really weird political choices. I won't talk about 2016. and so, you know, a great thinker once said that the statement, "I refuse to be deceived," could be the best way to deceive yourself.
Yes.
This is where these people are. They're so obsessed with warding off potential deceit that they can't believe anything. By the way, that thinker was Nietzsche.
Yeah.
So what do you do as czar about that? What do you do about the Eeyorism? It's just this kind of almost professional cynicism about the world.
Well, I think you have to hold people when they make a claim about things getting worse to citing data. And to call them on the fallacy that something bad is happening now, therefore things have gotten worse. Right. Now that's an error in arithmetic. You cannot make a claim about a trend from one data point.
Right.
You have to at least look at one other point in the past. Just holding op-ed writers to the standard that before you say something's getting worse, you have to compare now to some earlier period of time.
Right.
That would get rid of some of the Eeyorism.
So, Steve, on that note, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm not sure if reason can save us, but it's been fun thinking about it. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our guest has been Steven Pinker. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, the Stanford of the East, and a world-renowned cognitive scientist. He's also author of the very fine book, and many other fine books, but the very fine book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. So, Josh, are you feeling stirred and optimistic?
I am. I mean, not just from reading the book, but also from this conversation. Look, I definitely put Steve in as czar. I think, you know, if we could bring back a sense of responsibility to the facts and evidence and argument and these analytical ways of reaching judgments and not just one data point, I mean, I think we'd make real progress.
Well, I think we could if we could get everybody on board, but I think it's much harder. And there's parts of the book in which Stephen talks about how hard it is, about the politics right. And the tribalism in our politics. And I don't know. I think human cognition is really a mess. Sure, the cognitive avant-garde are cognitively well off, but I don't know that the mass of humanity is on the same page with those of us in the cognitive avant-garde.
They'll get there.
Well, maybe. We'll see. But you know what? This conversation, it continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with apologies to Descartes, get this, cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, either here or on the radio, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now it's time for some unreasonably fast talking from Ian Scholz, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholz, I have my suspicions that reason itself cannot haul us out of whatever global jam we may or not be in. It's all kind of murky, isn't it? For one thing, reason helped get us into whatever mess we're in the first place. We're not brains in jars playing chess telepathically with our body-deprived fellows. We're flesh and blood, hungry sex monsters, with instincts for survival that are enabled, but not always helped, by reasoning. Buying guns, for instance, a logical choice if you want venison or to defend your home from rabid invaders, but then your grandson's going to raid the cabinet and take out half his graduating class because Susie snubbed him at the prom. We think, but not ahead. We filter our brain through gauze and barbed wire. Reason has supplied us with all kinds of reasons for our personal behavior. Excuses, conditions, we're cisgen and entitled, we're libtards, we're alt-right, we're a person of color. Identity is all, which is all good, I guess, and unless you're a Nazi. Since the end of history, which I guess happened, we no longer have the Cold War to energize us here in the West. Also, with the Cold War gone, the West has slowly come to realize that China, the Mideast, Africa, Central, and South America are all places. With our own history books, or history apps, I suppose. Now, fear of Eastern infection is leading us back to the ideologies and obsessive behaviors that blew up the world in the first place. Case in point, the fear and hatred of George Soros by the right in the United States has spread to Hungary. Soros' homeland, where the current leader is dismantling all the philanthropic entities Soros created there. Sort of a junior version of Trump just setting fire to anything Obama touched. There's a logic to it. Sure, it's going to make America great again, if your definition of great is, wow, we can smoke in bars again after dipping our unfiltered cigarettes in Monsanto Roundup. The same people questioning our current state of greatness are the people who get mad at protesters for saying America isn't great. But then we all think it's horrible in different ways. Immigration and women and whiny liberals, global warming, corruption, incipient fascism. Which is it? And we think it's great because, what? Parades and jet skis, two-for-one sales, the promise just beyond the horizon of driverless cars. Certainly many of the things that made us great are fading. Movies, baseball, nice jobs. Independent contractors of the new workforce, we're supposed to embrace that because we have no choice in the matter. As a writer and actor, I'm used to it, but I answer to editors, directors, producers, clueless executives. Uber drivers, for example, get their orders from an app. Meet your new boss, not the same as your old boss. The new Mr. Dithers is a ringtone. Is that reasonable? Well, that's the trouble with reason in a fallen world. We apply reason to things that don't make much sense. World peace, end of hunger, no. We problem solve, like, how can I get a pizza faster? Can we make a robot that can tie shoes? Why can't I take a shower while I'm commuting? We're restless and whiny. We compose negative Yelp reviews. We figure out ways to destroy lives on Twitter. If we worry about global warming, it's because it's too hot. We have to take off our brand new sweater. Rising ocean levels means we're not going to drown. Mold in the drywall will be the next global issue. There's a global petulance. We don't care about the starving. We just don't want them coming over here and getting in the way. And we spend an awful lot of time snooping, spying, grassing, finger-waving, snubbing. We yearn for transparency. We have to know everything about everybody all the time. Otherwise, we're hiding something. We're not being authentic. We're toxic. We're lugging around baggage. Everything is meant to be seen. Forest, meet trees. Transparency, meet Merck. I gotta go.
Holding hands at the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Philosophy Talk is a production of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin. Special thanks to Andrew Unger, Gene Forstner, Amanda Hall, and the Kepler's Literary Foundation.
Thanks also to Sun Lee, Dan Brandon, Rebecca Barron, and our musical guest, Adam Schulman and on piano, and Tiffany Austin on vocals.
The senior producer of Philosophy Talk is Devin Strelovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Cindy Prince-Baum.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners in our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.